Brilliant. We are starting today a new series looking at six of the Psalms of King David on the run-up to Ian Seaside at the end of February. So we can look at six. We've got Bishop Mike, the new Bishop of Exeter, coming to speak on the 26th of January. So we're going to take a pause then, but that's worth putting in your diary. Don't miss that. He'll be speaking at both gatherings. So come on the 26th of January and hear the vision of Bishop Mike for the whole of Exeter and beyond, and how we play our part in that. But we're going to be looking at these Psalms, the Psalms of King David over the next few weeks. And my prayer, I think, as we look at these Psalms together, is that God would stir up in us a greater awareness of what He is doing in our world and in our lives at the moment. There's that God would like awaken us in a fresh way to the things of His kingdom that are right in front of us, that maybe in our everyday lives, in the busyness of everyday life, with everything that's going on, we sometimes miss or don't see what He's at work to do. So my prayer is that as we look at these Psalms together, there'll be like a stirring and an awakening in each of us in a fresh way. But I wanted just to start by giving a little introduction to the Psalms. I know there'll be many of us here who are familiar with what the Psalms are, and you'll know lots about them, but there'll be others of us here who don't know as much. And so just to put us all on a sort of similar footing to start off with, the book of the Psalms in the Scriptures, they're like the musical prayers of God's people through the generations. They were written and composed for use in worship by the ancient Israelites. And most, if not all, of the Psalms were originally composed for some kind of worship in the temple. So for God's people coming together to declare and to sing and to pray together as a community. And they've been sung in the temple for thousands of years, in the synagogues and churches since, and we still sing them in some ways today. So the Psalms differ from other parts of the Bible because they're sort of meant to be recited as songs or prayers of God's people together. 73 of the Psalms were written by David. So he's the most prolific psalm writer and songwriter. We can look at the Psalms of David over the next few weeks. But there's Psalms written by other people too. Moses wrote one psalm, Psalm 90. If you want to have a look at that one. Solomon, the son of David, wrote a couple of psalms as well. 72 and 127 are psalms of Solomon. And the way the psalms are set out, people think that the book of the psalms was set out so that people could use it in their daily devotional times as well. So they were set out to be corporate things, but also to be used in people's daily devotion as well. And even some people think that they were deliberately organized so that people could memorize all of the Psalms. So before people had a Bible of their own or the Psalms written down that they could access together, they would memorize the Psalms. There's a challenge for us in New Year's resolution for some, maybe. And the people of God have sung and memorized the Psalms through the centuries. I've got a quote for you from one of my favorite theologians, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And he says this, I think it will come up on the screen behind us. Great. In the Psalms, God's people have found the language of faith that expresses their struggles, their hopes, and fears. The Psalms teach us to pray. They unfold the range of human emotion. They remind us that God can handle our anguish, our anger, and our despair. And I love this. In every psalm, we hear the voice of Christ interceding or praying for us. Isn't that an amazing thing to think about as we read over the Psalms? In every psalm, we can hear the voice of Christ praying and interceding for us. As I've been reading about the Psalms, I came across this quote from a Scottish politician from the 18th century, a guy called Andrew Fletcher, who wrote in one of his books, "Let me write the songs of a nation, and I care not who writes its laws." Let me write the songs of a nation, I care not who writes its laws. He himself was obviously a politician, and he recognized the power of law, but he also recognized the power of song to capture and mold people's imaginations and attitudes to life. Songs do that, don't they? You got a favorite song that you sing, and every now and again you realize it's sort of like getting under your skin, it's sort of like changing the way you think. He realized that the Psalms are intended to do that for God's people. They're intended to do that for us, to capture and mold our imaginations and attitudes to life lived with God. That's what the Psalms are there for. And we can imagine all those who've gone before us praying and singing the same words that we have in front of us, that we've that Annie's read to us today. You know, Moses sang some of these words. Joshua, Miriam, Esther, Ruth, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Mary, the mother of Jesus, the disciples, the Apostle Paul. In fact, the early church was sort of instructed to continue singing the Psalms. Ephesians 5, verse 19 says this, "Address one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with your heart." It's a great command, isn't it? Colossians 3:16, Paul writes again to the church, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." Jesus sang these words that we have in front of us. Jesus knew them. It's likely he'd memorized them. It was traditional at the Passover meal to sing psalms. Psalms 113 to 118 were a fixture of the Passover meal. So at the Last Supper, when Jesus was sat with his friends celebrating the Passover, they were singing psalms, the same psalms that we have in front of us today. In Matthew 26:30, it says about the Last Supper, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out onto the Mount of Olives." So after the supper, they sing this hymn and they go out onto the Mount of Olives, and Jesus is beginning to face what is ahead of him in terms of betrayal, arrest, persecution in the harshest sense, and crucifixion. Jesus is singing these psalms before that moment. And he would have sung something from Psalm 115 to 118. Here's some of what he would have been singing. "Out of my distress, I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" Jesus was singing these words. "I shall not die, but I shall live and recount the deeds of the Lord. Open to me the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." Isn't that amazing? That Jesus was singing these words, that they were an established part of the Passover meal, and Jesus is singing them just before he goes to his death. Walter Brueggemann, another theologian, says this, "The Psalms are not only addressed to God, they are the voice of a gospel. God's good word addressed to God's faithful people. And in the Psalms, we hear the voice of God who meets us in our depths of need and in the heights of our celebration." So they're not just our words to God, they are God's words to us. So we're going to dive into Psalm 57. And before I do, I want to tell you about some danger that I once faced. There's a picture going to come up on the screen in front of us. Yes, I did not take this. I have some similar photos that have disappeared somewhere on a hard drive in the depths of my study somewhere. But a little while ago, I found myself with some friends in South Africa. And I fell in love with this country when I was there. I just absolutely love it. We were in Cape Town, and some friends who were there said, "Look, if you're in Cape Town, you've got to drive to this place called Hermanus, and you've got to go diving with great white sharks." And we were like, "Okay, all right, okay." So we signed up for this trip, and we drove out through the beautiful sort of Cape and to this place called Hermanus, where you can see whales and all kinds of other things as well. It's amazing. And we got on this boat, and they threw this cage over the side of the boat, and then they basically invited us to get in it. And you know, that was all fine until they start throwing sort of dead fish and chum in the water, you know, and sort of the water starts to go cloudy red and pink, and you kind of, and then you see, I saw one of the guys who works on the boat, who had a massive tuna head, and through the sort of like eye socket, he was putting a rope and tying it off, and then they started throwing this tuna head into the water and dragging it in front of the cage. And at that moment, I watched a few other people get in the cage first. You know, I've been trained in the ways of wisdom, and watch others first. There was this moment where we first saw a great white shark, and this Swedish guy was in one of the slots in the cage. And they get the yell at this guy, "Get down, get down." So you have to like go push yourself down under the water. You're looking at this, looking for this shark. And then they pull the tuna head in front, and the shark slammed into the side of the cage. And with such force, the whole boat shook. And this Swedish guy, you know, his head comes up out of the water and he starts just screaming. And then they're like, right, who else wants to go, you know? So I did get in the cage, but it was a moment in my life where I realized I was in sort of more danger than normal. After this experience, nothing that dramatic happened when we were in the cage, but we just saw these beasts up close, and they were absolutely awe-inspiring things. You know, when they move in the water and they're, you know, the way that they are, it's just incredible. But it was a moment of danger that I found was having an impact on my prayer life. You ever had those moments? Yeah, where you feel like I'm going to prayer quicker than I might normally in this situation as I face these great white sharks. And Psalm 57 is a moment in the life of King David where he is facing significant danger, and we get a little insight into his prayer life in this moment. So let's unpack it together. If you've got it, if you've got the Psalm, I don't know if you can read this, but I have it out on your phones or on a Bible if you like. I'll try and refer to it as much as I can as I go through. But Psalm 57 was written around a time where King David had been anointed king of Israel, but wasn't yet king. If you know the story of ancient Israel and how David fits into this story, David is the shepherd boy who kills Goliath, and he's anointed as king over Israel. But there is another king in place at that moment before David can take the throne. And they have this very strange relationship where David is kind of drawn into the courts of the king. He's seen for a leader. He's got sort of like military prowess, and he knows what he's doing with an army and that kind of thing. But Saul, the king, begins to become jealous of David. As David has these military victories, people start to sing songs about him. They start comparing him to the other king. They want to follow him. They love him. And Saul becomes jealous of David. And he starts to try and actually kill him. And on several occasions, he attempts that. And this is not a happy period in David's life. It is difficult. He's being persecuted. He's been betrayed. He's often facing difficult situations. My Bible, I've got the NIV version, and it has a little intro to this psalm, which says, this psalm was from when David had fled from Saul into a cave. So David is hiding in a cave. It's not a great time in his life. And apparently, even the psalm was set to a tune called Do Not Destroy. So even musically, we're not in a happy place. This is a really troubling time in David's life. We have that line in verse 1, I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. So there is disaster that he feels is coming after him. Verse 4, I'm in the midst of lions. I'm forced to dwell among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. So you get the idea, don't you, by what David's saying, that he's in a really difficult place. And we start to see how David responds in prayer to being in this difficult place. So just take on board for a minute, you know, for each of us as we face 2025, there are going to be moments of, you know, in faith, great joy and celebration and excellent moments in each of our lives. But there might be moments for all of us where we find ourselves in a difficult place like David, in a cave, metaphorically speaking, where our backs are against the wall and we've got a choice of how we respond to that moment. Watch how David responds in this moment. As you read through the psalm, I wonder if you noticed it as Annie read, David starts to say out loud all the ways that he sees who God is in this moment. Or all the ways that God is revealing himself to David in this moment. Have a look with me. In verse 1, he says, you're the merciful one. He's the refuge, the hiding place, the loving, protecting mother, shielding her chicks with her wings in verse 1. He's the God most high over all things in verse 2. He's the one who vindicates or makes things right in verse 2. He's the sender of help from heaven in verse 3. This is who David sees is with him in the cave. He's the sender of help from heaven in verse 3. He's the one who can save in verse 3. He's the rebuker of the unjust in verse 3. He's the source of perfect love and faithfulness that finds him even in a cave in verse 3. He's exalted above the heavens, verse 5. He is glorious over all the earth, verse 5. He's worthy of praise, verse 9. He is sung of among the nations, verse 9. He's the one whose love for us reaches to the heavens, verse 10. He's the one whose faithfulness reaches to the skies, verse 10. He's exalted above the heavens, verse 11. He is glorious over all the earth, verse 11. It is staggering to me that in the midst of what David is facing in his life, in this cave, alone, hunted, persecuted, vulnerable, his view of God is larger than all his problems and all the unfulfilled promises in his life, isn't it? His view of God is bigger than all the things he's facing. If we were to sing this psalm, put it to music and to words, what would ring loudest in our ears would not be the danger he's in or the roar of the lions around him. It would be the glory of God, the tenderness of God, the power of God, the faithfulness of God over the situation David finds himself in. One theologian I read on this said, he delights that God is with him in the cave. God is with him in the cave. So there's four things I want to look at really quickly. And I tried to make this short because I thought we were all going to be freezing. I think it's warmer than we expected, I hope. First thing I want to just point out that we kind of see and we pick up through this psalm is that David's eyes are fixed on God. He looks to God in the midst of his circumstance. He looks to God. Can I encourage you, and I speak to myself in this, that this could be a year of us expanding our view of who God is and getting a bigger perspective of who God is. Why not make that an aim of this year? God, or a prayer? God, I want to have a bigger view of you by the end of this year than I do now at the beginning. David has a big view of God and he looks to God in the midst of his circumstance. Why is that important? Because I don't know about you, but when I face problems in my life, when I find that I am in a cave like David, what tends to happen to me is that I can turn back or my attention can be drawn away from God onto the circumstances I find myself in. Anyone else have that familiar moment, you know, where you start looking around, you realize quite how bad it is. There's this and this and this and this, and oh my goodness, everything feels big. David doesn't have that kind of approach. His eyes are fixed on God. He looks to God in the midst of his problem. And he says this in verse 7, my heart, O God, is steadfast. My heart is steadfast. It's like he's made a decision of where his heart is going to be focused. And it is on God, not on the cave that he's in and the situation that he is facing. Are we going to be a people, a church, who this year look to God and are focused on God, not on the circumstances around us? Let's resolve to be that as a family, to call one another, to keep our eyes fixed on God. Number two, he hides in God. So he's focused on God, but he hides in God. He looks to God as the source of his answer. Verse 1, have mercy on me, my God, have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. In you I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. What if this was a year for us where our view of God grew, but also it's a year where we decide to go deeper in the things of trusting God more than earthly things? Problems in our lives can sometimes cause us to put our trust in earthly answers. Don't know if you've found that as well. When we face problems and situations in our lives, we can sometimes look for earthly answers or insights into how to get through them rather than choosing to put our answer in God. Psalm 20 verse 7 says this, some trust in chariots and some trust in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. It's David talking again. We trust in the name of the Lord our God. Is it going to be a year where we trust in horses or chariots, or are we going to trust in the name of the Lord our God? I said this, the picture of the shark earlier was from a trip that I went on to South Africa. And after I came back from that holiday, I had this very strange moment. I was a youth pastor at the time, working in a place called Chorley Wood in North London, and I was a youth pastor, and I loved my job working with young people. But there was this moment in the airport where I, as close to an audible voice as I think I've ever heard, sat down at a restaurant with my three friends. We all survived the cage diving, the shark diving. So I sat down at a restaurant in the airport, and I almost audibly heard God say to me, give up your job. And it was more specific. It was about give your job to Fiona, who I worked with at the time. And I had this really weird moment of, I'd never really experienced anything quite as sort of like firm, kind of almost like an audible voice it was. And so I went back to Chorley Wood, and I had to have this moment of discussion with the vicar at the time, which is, I sat down in an airport and I think I heard God tell me to give up my job, which was a weird conversation to have, but he got it. We went through this process of me handing over my job to this amazing youth leader who was working with me at the time called Fiona. But then I was a bit like, God, what do I do? So what do I do now? I don't have a job. So I decided I'll go back to South Africa. I liked it there. And so I arranged this trip, and I thought, we found this great church out there. I'm going to go back to South Africa. I'm going to arrange this trip. And so I'm going to go out for a few months, see if I can sort of learn more from this church that we'd been around, and I loved it. Anyway, my job was finishing in the summer, and the last thing I was doing was like a youth camp for these young people. There was with a few other different churches. I remember thinking, at the end of this youth camp, there's a couple of weeks, and then I'm meant to be flying to South Africa, and I don't have anything really sorted yet. I don't have any transport for when I'm there. I don't have anywhere to live. I haven't really got an agreement with this church that it would be okay for me to sort of be around. I don't have enough money to be there. I don't know really a lot about South Africa, and I hear it's the kind of place you might want to have a bit of a clue about as you go there. And I had all these things that I was sort of I didn't possess. Yeah, all these sort of worries and concerns. And I remember walking into sort of this space where the young people were going to come and have their worship meeting before they all got there. And as I went into this space, I just remember making this prayer and just going like, Lord, I don't have enough money. I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm working, where I'm going to live. I need you to provide for me in this moment as I kind of trust you. And I just remember hearing this kind of like, not again, it wasn't like an audible voice, but just this real sense of no in response to my asking. And when you hear a no from God, you're like, okay, there's something in this. You know, you sort of want to lean in a little bit more because I know the things I'm asking for aren't necessarily bad. I remember just leaning in and being like, Lord, what's going on here? And I just remember this sense of like God saying to me, Bob, I want to be what you need in South Africa. I will be what you need. I will be your bank manager. I will be your tour guide. I will be your transportation. I will be your accommodation. I will be your security guard. I will be your sat nav. I will be everything that you need if you let me. And there was this moment for me of deciding, am I going to put my trust in all the earthly things that I think are needed for a trip like that? Or am I going to trust that God is enough, that he is enough, if I seek him first? It was an amazing adventure. And God taught me loads about what it really means to look to him for provision. It wasn't easy. It was difficult. And I made lots of mistakes along the way. But it was wonderful, a wonderful trip. He is what we need. The third thing we get from this psalm is that David speaks about God. So he looks to God, he hides in God, but he speaks about God. He declares who God is in the midst of his pain. In verse 2, he says, I cry out to God Most High, who vindicates me. I will sing and make music, verse 7. Verse 9, I will praise you, Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples. There are moments in this psalm where in the midst of the cave, David is opening his mouth and stuff is coming out of his mouth. He is making declarations, statements. Is this going to be a year that we as a church use our voice to declare truths about who God is before we give God our problems? I love that he doesn't give his problems more airtime than the greatness of God in this psalm. What gets the airtime is the greatness of God. The problems are mentioned, the problems are brought to God, but what gets the airtime is the greatness of God. What we speak has power, doesn't it? You know that? Yeah, what we speak has real power. I've had a moment with my family this year, this Christmas, where Hudson, our littlest, is 2.5, and he's learning to talk, and he's getting there slowly. He's learned the word stinky from his sisters, and he keeps attributing it to me. Yes, stinky daddy is quite a familiar phrase around our house. And then during Christmas time, he's learnt not donkey, but conky. So over Christmas, he's jumped on my back a lot and called me stinky conky repeatedly. And what I've noticed after a little while of being called stinky conky again and again, of course the girls have cottoned on as well, is that it actually starts to have a slight effect on me. I'm like, gosh, I've been called stinky conky about 6,000 times today and it's actually wearing me down. And I was thinking about this the other day, I was like, this is a ridiculous example to use, but even Hudson's voice and what he says, it actually does start to have an impact on me. And, you know, being called these things over and over again, our words have power, don't they? I've been doing, at the beginning of this year, this resource called Bread, which has been put together by King's Cross Church in London. And it's just a journal, a way of journaling through the year, reading scripture and sort of writing about it. You can get it on Amazon. It's about 10 quid. And it just takes you through loads and loads of passages of scripture through the year. It's a wonderful thing. First of January, Psalm 8. And I read this. And it stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, I've been thinking about it. It's spinning me out for days. Psalm 8 says this: through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies. Lucy, can you just stand up with Clara just for a second? Look, this is Clara. Isn't she beautiful? Look, through the praise of children and infants, God has established a stronghold against his enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. Thanks, Lucy. Isn't that an amazing thing? Through the praise of children and infants, God can establish a stronghold. That's been messing with my head all week. Like, God, how do you do that? Isn't that amazing that these little ones have such power in what they praise and worship and speak out? There is power in our words. What are your words going to say in 2025? And lastly, this. David is awake to the goodness of God. David is awake to the goodness of God. He calls his innermost being to awaken to the reality of the goodness of God. I want to ask you, is this a year that could be a year of awakening up to more of the goodness of God in your life? David is not going to let himself be spiritually asleep to the greatness and the rescue of God in his situation. He's going to notice it. He's going to be awake to it. He's going to be fully aware of who it is that rescues him and delivers him from this situation. It's not going to be an accident. It's not going to be something that just happens, a coincidence. He knows he's going to be awake to the fact that it's God who's going to intervene in his situation. God is going to be at work ahead of you this year, wherever you go. God is on your side. And his plans are to give you a hope and a future in this year, in 2025. Do you believe that? Yeah? Christmas is a lovely time, isn't it? It's a wonderful time. It's a time to remember, amidst all the holly and the ivy, that God stepped out of heaven and put on flesh to tell you and me how much we meant to him. He gave up his life to show you and me how much he loved us and to make a way for us to experience that love for all eternity. He gave you his power to make that love real to others in our world so they might know him too. Are we awake to that reality in our life, in our lives? Are we awake to the goodness of God that is at work? I finish with this thought. There's one thing I found particularly interesting is looking at this psalm. You know, David is probably regarded as the greatest worship leader of the Old Testament. He wrote all his psalms and he sang all his songs and he chose all his choir leaders and choir masters and led all his processions and gave a great biblical model for God-centered worship before the people of Israel had any building that they could enter for worship. The greatest worship leader of the Old Testament did it all without a building. It was his son Solomon who built the temple, not David. So I just think, as I've been reading over this, there's a challenge for us, isn't there, as God's people, not to wait until Sunday to sing our songs of worship. Not to let the best song of worship that you sing be in here, but to be out there in the midst of the day-to-day, in our workplaces, in schools, in colleges, universities, in our streets, in our gardens, in our parks, at Budley, on Dartmoor, in the hard times and the good times. Our song is to be sung just as much out there as it is in here. Amen. Amen.